appreciated some of the input I got over lunch hour, and it's always good to think through what you teach and preach, because I always like to find challenges, because it helps you think through. Helps you think through what you're teaching, and that's good for all of us. Now, this afternoon's subject is it's not one with a biblical basis like we might think sometimes. This is a history lesson this afternoon. I don't know if you knew that or not, but that's at least the way I took it. It's just simply a history lesson, and when you look at history, it doesn't necessarily mean that what they did was right. I mean, don't you agree with that? Just because it's history doesn't mean it was right. And, you know, even some things in the Bible, and some people maybe struggle with it a little bit, but just because some of the people in the Bible did things they did doesn't necessarily mean it was the way to do it. Like, for an illustration, maybe when Paul circumcised Timothy, you know, I don't know, I think he might have made a mistake there, especially in light of all his teachings, and you look at the Galatians and look at how he taught there, and you think, wow, Paul, what'd you do? And so I just throw that out for whatever it's worth. And as we look at some of the history here, it doesn't mean it did everything right. But there are really things we can learn from looking back. And I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed the study looking back in history and seeing how we came to where we're at here today. So first of all, looking at maybe why should we study history, turn with me to Romans chapter 15. Look at a basis for why we should even look at this subject here tonight, here this afternoon. Romans chapter 15, talking about the Old Testament here. For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Now the God of consolation, the God of patience and consolation, grant you to be like-minded one toward another according to Christ Jesus. Ye may with one mind and one mouth glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. I really do enjoy going back in the Old Testament and reading some of the stories. I recently came through Genesis and thinking of Abraham and Lot and then Joseph. You know, I just enjoyed reading those stories again and learning again, looking at the lessons they learned, looking at how they lived their life, and looking at the mistakes that they made and trying to think about, you know, not to repeat those mistakes in my life. And so we can study history because we do learn. We can learn from other people's strong points. We can learn from other people's weak points. And studying history brings comfort and hope for the future. You know, just as Brother Anthony taught there, how God was faithful to them. You know, God was faithful to men and women in the past, and God will be faithful to us if we allow him to be. And we can see that in studying history. And also maybe in Jeremiah chapter 6, I think you probably know these verses. They're familiar verses that talk about history, but we'll look at these verses here at the start of the subject. But Jeremiah chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. Thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. Also I set watchmen over you, saying, hearken to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, we will not hearken. Stand in the way and see, and ask for the old paths. And one of the things that I think we can learn from history is that as we look back and we look at how men and women lived in the past, and we can look at what they did right, and we can look at their mistakes, and it can help give us a direction for the future. I was challenged by that. And, you know, there's even the one thing I'll probably bring up here this afternoon that was changed that in around the 1900s, I think they made a mistake, but I could be wrong. Just my opinion. It's something that we'll look at. It's something they did for hundreds of years and then was changed around the 19th century. But, so anyhow, we're going to look at some of the old paths here today. And I did get a lot of my information from the book, Mennonite Attire Through Four Centuries by Melvin Gingrich. And I was going to bring the book in just to show you a picture of what it looks like. Now, I was not really planning to take the book and read out of it here this afternoon because I don't know, I just don't always like that kind of teaching or preaching, even though it may have a place. And so some of what I share here, or a lot of what I share, I glean from that book. And it's a good book. It gives an overall picture of the years from 1500 until, well, 1980, something like that, 1950 more or less. And so one of the first point I'd like to look at is, what did plain dress do for those in the past? And that term plain dress, again, as I say it, that is, we use that term because that is how people talk about it. There was plain dress. That's how they talk about it in reference to Mennonites and Amish and this group. Now, it's interesting to me, there was men who studied into this subject, and they came away, and this is what they said. And so my points under number one are not necessarily what I come up with. It's what, as these men studied history, they said, this is what it does for this group of people. And I found that interesting. You know, Jesus said in John chapter 4, if I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. And it's interesting that we don't have any words in the Bible that Jesus wrote down specifically for us. But rather, we have four Gospels, witnesses that witness what Jesus did, and a witness is more powerful than what anyone will say about themselves. And so I found it, I just wanted to go through these points here, and the first point, just because I feel like people who look on and they witness it and they say this is what happens, that maybe it would hold more clout than if I say what I think it would be. And so anyhow, so the first one that they said that happens here, for those who, what it can do for us, what did plain dress do for those in the past? The letter A, it erases social tension and social barriers within the group. The children of the poor wear the same kind of clothing as the children of the rich in institutions where school uniforms is demanded. And I don't know if you have any of those schools around here, but even today in just some of the Catholic schools and things like that, they require a uniform. And one of the reasons that they do that is to just erase some of the social barriers and tension that can arise from having all the different social groups. And so they looked at that as some of the same, where it takes away some of that tension. Uniform clothing enhances their feeling of brotherhood. Their system would be doomed if competition to surpass the neighboring clothing fashions were tolerated. Letter B, there is witness value in uniform plain dress. Just as a nurse is recognized by her uniform that she is a person who is willing and able to help someone with physical needs, so Mennonites should be recognized as soldiers of the cross who are always ready to minister to the needs of humanity, both on a spiritual and physical level. And Charles Finney said, and this is not about Mennonites, but he said, those who does not know that the Methodists, when they were noted for their plain dress and renouncing the fashions and show of the world, used to have the power of prayer, and they had the universal respect of the world as sincere Christians. And I don't know what all brought that statement on, but we all know that the Methodists today not only do not have any separation of any kind, but have as accepted sin into the church by large scale. And Charles Finney is saying that, but when they were living separate from the world, they had a power of prayer that they did not have now, did not have when he wrote that statement. Letter C, it takes care of the problem of covetousness and envy. The people who dress simply and follow the simple standard of living will not become the object of envy and covetousness. And thinking about some of our principles we looked at here this morning, you know, if I wear clothing that's showy and brings a lot of attention to myself, well, you know, that's what happens. Your friends, you become a little bit jealous. Well, yeah, look at her, and she gets all the attention, or he gets all the attention. And where if you have a standard of simple dress, it takes away that problem. And if everybody's dressing simple, there's really nothing to be covetous about, right? Also, it takes care of, you know, the person who's spending lots of money on designer style jeans and designer clothing, or, you know, the high-end clothing, or whatever you want to call it, they have less money to put in the offering, and they have less money to give to the poor, to help other people out, and probably have less time to even to even help with needs of the community because they have to make their money so they can spend it on themselves. But when we create that kind of life, when we have that kind of lifestyle, we can become responsible for the struggles of other people because we're living a lifestyle that is outside of biblical principle and cause other people to struggle. Letter D is another thing that they noticed, that plain dress set a course for the future generation. Visual symbols, especially those associated with plain dress, have served the group as a working tool for maintaining group consciousness. For the plain people, the symbol of dress met not only a religious need, but a deep psychological need as well. Plain clothing was a part of an entire set of values which they were committed to perpetuate. And one of the things that you have to understand is some of these statements they made, that they were studying not only the Mennonites, but they were also studying the Hutterites and the Amish and some of that. And so that's, once in a while, you can see some of that woven into some of the things that they noted. I'd like to, point number two, look at clothing and class distinction in times past. And this was interesting to me. I knew it, but I didn't realize quite to this extent. But this, it helped also to bring it clear to me. Our family took a trip to Williamsburg this past summer, and that was helpful to me in thinking about the history of how people used to dress. And they had this introduction screen there that you sat. I think it was about 30 minutes long, that they introduced, you know, Williamsburg, and they introduced what was happening and through that year of time and everything. And so I saw some of this there. But during the 16th, 17th, 18th century, both men and women of the upper class continued to display their wealth in their clothing. A man's garb was an indication of his wealth for all the world to see. Even as late as the American Revolution, the wardrobe of a certain Colonel Gentleman Lord Stirling consisted of 43 pairs of breeches, some being of claret color, scarlet or crimson cloth. Some were of gold face, and others were of figured velvet, 31 coats. Some were of white or cinnamon silk, and also coats of cloth of every color. 58 waistcoats of rainbow hues and rich materials and ornamentation, 30 shekels, 119 pair of hose, this is a man, mostly silk, 54 cravats, which is the necklace that they wore in olden times. You might not even know it unless you saw a picture. 20 pairs of shoes, etc. This was how men dressed. And if you go back to the pictures there at Williamsburg, it was interesting to me that the men of upper class and the men who were making the decisions, who all were they? George Washington, John Adams, and I forget some of the names now. But they were men. When you see them having their meeting, I mean, they were all dressed up with just, they were very fancy, if I can just put it in those terms. And that was a part of dress in the years past, where men dressed up very frivolous. And it's kind of hard for me to understand why they did that. But not only that, in the European, and in contrast to that, the peasants of the day wore humble, serviceable clothing. The European government had strict regulations that you dress according to your class. So, and it was also interesting, there was three classes of people there was regulation that if you were of the lower class, you dare not wear clothes of the upper class. And if you were of middle class, you dare not wear the upper, if you're lower class, you dare not wear middle or upper. If you're middle, you dare not wear the clothes of the upper class. And that was, it seemed like it was believed in very strong. And so it's kind of hard for us to understand. But this, the way the men dressed, this dressing of men, on these classes, that started to fade away in the 18th century to the point that Napoleon tried hard to bring back elaborate clothing in men, but he was unsuccessful. And so he died in 1821, so apparently before that, it was must have been on the decline before, I'm going to say around 1800. And so that the classy dress of men was something that faded away that long ago. And men realized the wearing of clothing of the working class were much more comfortable and suitable for everyday life than the elaborate velvets, silks, and embroiders and they refused to go back to them. Yeah, I'm sure glad they did, because I sure wouldn't want to wear anything like that. It didn't seem to be very serviceable, even if we didn't have conviction against it. But the decline on formality of dress for men has continued to decline. Ever since that time, there's been a decline on formal attire, the abandonment of traditional rules of dress, and a steady decline of wearing tailored clothing. Now, I wonder how many of you here have ever worn tailored clothing or maybe had a tailored suit? But maybe some of the older men, maybe you never did. I never have. But I know my dad one time got a suit tailored, especially for him. And so that's just slowly on its way out. And it's true, you know, today at work, you can meet a wealthy man, very wealthy man. He might be dressed in shorts and t-shirt. You know, just that's how it has changed to that point. Now, he may have gold rings or something like that, or gold watch or expensive watch to kind of show off his wealth. But other than that, their clothing is with common people of the day. Now, that was, men kind of made that dramatic shift then. While it continued to kind of go downhill, women's clothes didn't change till more of a later date. So number three, the history of regulation on dress. For four centuries, 1500 through 1800, most Mennonites responded to the class distinctions by simply asking their people to stay away from the extreme styles of the day, to wear the clothing that peasants wore. They did not have a uniform style of clothing. And that was interesting to me. It is true that there were some groups that had maybe what we call a few standards, that they had a few standards in their churches. But for the most part, in the early years, the Anabaptists did not have church standards. They'd simply asked their people to wear the common clothes of the day. And we'll look a little later at what the common clothes of the day was. However, they preached strongly against a lifestyle of extravagance. An excerpt from Menno Simons talking about the upper class, here's what he said. They say they believe, and yet alas, there are no limits to their accursed haughtiness. Foolish pride and pomp, they parade in silks, velvet, costly clothes, gold rings, chains, silver belts, pins, buttons, curiously adorned shirts, shawls, collar veil, aprons, velvet, shoes, slippers, and such like foolish finery. And that was his way he preached. And I know... We all, you know, Mennonites are named after Menno Simons, but wow, I'm not sure how much we always follow Menno Simons. Now, there was in the book that I talked to you about there was one set of standards there in 1659 by an old Flemish Anabaptist group, and this was probably among the most stringent, okay? So I'm going to give these to you. Letter A, that a Christian should not wear crimson linen or collared or shiny clothing. That adults should not permit their children to dress in a manner that is considered improper. That Christians should not wear high-heeled shoes or shoes decorated with white yarn, nor two straps or spy holes. Letter D, that one should not wear clothes of the latest style or worldly fashions, but plain clothes as suggested in Romans 12, verse 2. That also the top of the shirts should not be colored or too tightly bound, nor decorated with cords at the bottom, nor starched underwear stiffened with bones, or shiny, smooth, shiny blouses with curved elbows according to worldly fashion. I think I said shirts, it's skirts. Describing a woman's skirts. Letter F, that a Christian should not wear iron or starched shirt collar. That they should not decorate, letter G, they should not decorate their hair by braiding or binding with cords, nor wear golden coverings or earrings under the hoods. Letter H, a Christian should not use costly or fancy tableware. You imagine having that in the standard. And then very last one, no Christian man should wear long hair on his head or cut their beard or shave according to worldly style. And so that was among the most stringent of rules that I think was had during that time. And you know, to many people, maybe it sounds appealing to say, you know what, let's just wear the clothes of the common folk of that day. But that's not quite the whole story. Let's continue on thinking about this a little bit. Now remember that we're talking about a time period or an era of time that the church and the state were not separate. Okay? Remember that. That's an important thing for us to understand as we continue on. Ancient Rome had laws regarding the amount of clothing a woman dared own. In the cities of Switzerland, much later, this kind of legislation was continued and actually became increasingly strict, so that city councils even went so far as to describe the length of garments, the length of shoe point, or height of bonnets. In New England, such laws were very common because of the Puritan belief, which regarded ornamentation not only as extravagance, but also as sin. And so, girls, how would you like it if the police officer was the one that was stopping you and saying your shoes have too much of a point on them, you need to get them changed? It was a completely different era of time. But remember, the church and state was not separate, and so the state, or however you want to, they regulated clothing at that point. Now, it was also during this time, in the 1600s, Jacob Ammon, he was the one that split away from the brethren, mostly because he believed in banning those who were excommunicated. But he was also responsible for prescribing a certain type of clothing that his people must wear. And as I understand, not only did he prescribe it, but he also excommunicated those who did not follow through with his pattern. And it was interesting, there were some letters there in some of how the Anabaptist men felt about Jacob Ammon. And I don't know if scathing is quite the word, it might be a little strong, but they wrote against his type of administration and the way he administrated there. And one of their big problems was that you would excommunicate, first of all, you would set a standard of clothing that it says the New Testament doesn't give any precedent for that, and you would excommunicate for that. And it was interesting, that's where their hang-up was, that if you asked for a certain type of clothing and you didn't require obedience, well, how's that supposed to work? But to excommunicate for something that you didn't have a biblical basis with couldn't understand that. And that's the way I understand Jacob Ammon did. He excommunicated those who did not agree with him or did not follow through with what he asked. And we'll pick that up again tonight a little wee bit. But we do see what that kind of administration produces in the Amish today. You know what it is. And so that's something for us to think about as we think about the future. What produces what? While women's dresses changed some during the 15th, 18th century, it was very common, or we could say it was simply the way society did, that the women's dresses, their sleeves came below the elbow, and their skirts went to the ankles. And that was actually, in Williamsburg, that's how they dressed. The women in Williamsburg, they all dressed with their skirts went to the ankles, and their sleeves came to the elbows. And I found it interesting, so I started asking, I'd find a lady and I'd ask her, and I said, was this regulation back then? And I think one or so, maybe she didn't really like my question. I'm not sure. I think maybe she, not sure what the problem was. But anyhow, they said there was no regulation. It was simply, if you didn't dress like that, you were not accepted in society. Like, if there was a woman that would have dressed immodestly, she would have been rejected by her friends and by the local community. That's just the way it was. And if you wanted to be invited to tea, if you wanted to be socially acceptable, you dressed modest. That was just the way it was. And, man, I just can't hardly fathom. I cannot hardly fathom if we would go out on, and every woman in Lebanon County or wherever you live, the skirts went to the ankles and everything and came below their elbows. Can you imagine that? But that was how they dressed. Now, compare that with America today. And I did just a little wee bit of research on this because it's hard to fit to research. And that is, the way I understand is that in America today, the only way you get in trouble is, the only way you get in trouble for today is for complete nakedness. And in some cities, that is even tolerated. Now, I just give that for you to help us understand that there is no connection between the society where women, all women, including worldly women, dressed with their skirts to the ankles, sleeves the elbows with what we have today. I mean, the societies are so different, and so the influence that we are facing is so different. I'd also say that to help us understand that, you know, they could do that back then and just simply tell their people to wear the simple clothes of society. That would make sense if everybody dressed that way, right? You sure can't do that today. And furthermore, one of the things that was so different from what we have today is that they only had so much option. I mean, you only went down to the store, a local store, and you only had your normal colors. You go to buy shoes, you only had black and blue to choose from, black and brown to choose from. And so, in other words, they didn't have options like we do today. Now, okay, that all started to change. See, so just thinking about a few dates here, to me, this is interesting. We had the years of 1500 to 1700. We have here government regulation on dress, okay? But then we have the years, I'm going to say right around 1800 to 1900. Here we have the Industrial Revolution starting. And I'm going to put here this kind of as a transition. It's just at least that kind of how it felt to me as I read through the history book. And we had these years here where, and probably before 1500, where nothing really changed a lot. You know, that's just, and then we had the years of 1800, 1900, where Industrial Revolution started to come in, and the Industrial Revolution, they made clothing more affordable, and also it gave them more options to choose from. And we also had women starting to enter into the workforce and some of that. And so that was kind of a transition point. And then you have 1900 through today. And that was, in 1900 is when, at least it appeared to me, that was when church regulation, that was when rules, some of that started to come into place. Church standards, they started to wrestle with that and trying to find a way for their people. And so, 1920, and not quite to the day, 1920 was a time when, with morals declining, very little government regulation on dress, and the church is still struggling with it. There was a big shift in about 1920, and that's close enough history, y'all probably, you don't remember it, but you at least remember people talking about it, is when the hems really came up, the skirts got short, and morals just went downhill. And the church did follow the world in that, and we'll look at that here a little bit later as well. But in the 1800s, the church was still trying to have simplicity in clothing without uniformity. A lot of church leaders, they wanted simplicity, but they were hesitant to get to the point to say, we want a certain type of clothing. They wrestled that was the right way to do it. And there was men like John S. Kaufman, John F. Funk, and Daniel Kaufman. They were very influential in teaching against fashion and worldliness. And especially John S. Kaufman, a lot of you would probably remember him. He was the one who was a big evangelist. But he was desperately trying to hold on to not going to where they had to have a uniform practice. And he preached very strongly and probably very adamantly about the lifestyle and have simple clothing. Because he was trying to just bring it to have what I think a lot of us would wish we could do, is you teach the principles and people live it out. And he tried desperately to hold on to that. But and as time continued to go and things continued to decline, then there was men like George R. Brunk Sr., A.D. Wenger, Sanford Shetler, and Oscar Burkholder. They were men who were very influential through the avenue of holding Bible nonconformity conferences on simplicity and nonconformity. There are also many articles written on this subject in the Herald of Truth during this time period. And so some of that, it was during some of that transition that men started to say, you know what, if we're going to make it, or if we're going to have any kind of separation, we're going to have to require, we're going to have some regulations on dress. That's where they finally came to. And I think all of that was because of the tremendous pressure of the world. You know, we had the 1920s, the start of tremendous moral decline, and all that happened through that time period. These men, some of these men, though, holding these conferences, these men actually succeeded in bringing in a period of more conservative dress than was known in Mennonite circles during the days of their fathers. The rigid position on dress after the early 1900s that we still have today was a direct result of the Great Awakening. The Great Awakening stresses conversion, holy living, dedication to the ideals of church, and practical piety. There was also a breaking away from some of the traditions of the past. They stressed Sunday schools, higher education, evangelistic meetings, and publication. It was also during that time the church leaders began to realize without church standards a group would lose out. And that all changed because of the changes in society, like we talked about. And at least that just appears the way it was, because for so many years they were okay with the way it worked. But at that point they had government regulation. They had people saying, telling society how to dress. Then we had this transition period. Then we had the period where church leaders finally said we need to have some kind of regulation on how we're going to work together. So now, number four is clothing worn by people in the past to the present. And this just kind of tells us how we got to where we are. For the women, up until the 1920s, most women wore skirts to the ankles and sleeves covered to the elbows. After the 1920s, the church followed the world, and they brought the hems up. And if you follow the pictures of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that's what you see in that time period is a direct result of the 1920s. And so that's really where that changed. And today, it became the style to... I'm trying to think if I missed a point from earlier. No, it's here ahead of me yet. Okay. Today, it became the style to wear longer dresses, and so that is one reason why maybe many of you have longer dresses. The cape was a part of dress as far back as 1500, and it was interesting to me that even some of society actually wore a cape. Now, the cape had different styles up through the years, and I will not go into those different styles, and just by my observation, it sometimes it seemed to serve the purpose well, and other times it had much to be desired. But that concept has been for many years. It was even part of society way back. The cape did actually disappear a little bit there around in the mid-1800s, but that was brought back through the teachings in the Great Awakening. Now, up till 1920, there was very little talk about socks and shoes because the dresses came to the ankles. Actually, I understand there was no regulation ever on socks and shoes until the 1920s when the hems came up. The hems got shorter, and all of a sudden the church said, well, if that's going to happen, I guess we're going to have to regulate the socks and the shoes. And I think they made a mistake there. I think they should have told them, I know it's probably been hard, but ladies, keep the hems down. It saved us a lot of grief today. That's my opinion. But anyhow, socks were black or white, with the preferred color being white. Now, this is back when the hems were the whole way down. Many pioneer women were barefoot. And when the hems came up in the 1920s and flesh-colored hose was available, there came the need to regulate socks and shoe color. And this is when I understand, I think it's Franconia Conference, at that point asked for black. As far as the covering, all women covered their heads. In the early centuries, those coverings would have been bigger than what you all wear. Even when we were there in Williamsburg, it was interesting to me that the women there, as they were trying to replicate that ear, they had bigger coverings on than what you all have. And they covered, you know, they were big coverings. But as the Industrial Revolution came along and women joined the workforce, all that started to change in the 1800s. Even as late as in the late 1800s, there's pictures of Mennonite women without a covering on. And so that actually fell back And then again, through the Great Awakening, that was brought back. Now for the men, so that's kind of how you got to where you are today. All right, that was kind of the shift. That's how you got to where we are today. Now for the men, the knee breeches and long stockings were the way they dressed until late 1700s, early 1800s. And it was the way of most things that some people, you know, for some people that tradition died very hard. And some of the older men, just that was hard for them to give up that tradition, but that eventually faded in the background, was replaced by long trousers that similar to what we have today. Broadcloth pants were what everyone wore, including society, until about 1840. About 1820, it became fashionable to have buttons instead of the flap. This change probably did not become accepted in the Mennonite Church until late 1800, but was eventually accepted without a lot of controversy. Men's shoes, many Anabaptist men would have worn low shoes with buckles, but high boots came in during the 17th and 18th century. And the Mennonites were slow to discontinue their use. I just had to think of, they had pictures there of men with their high boots on. And of course, that to people today, you know, that would sound appealing to wear that probably. But I want you to think about why they probably had to have high boots. You know, this summer, if you wouldn't have had paved roads to run your carriage on, you'd have needed high boots or you'd have been in trouble. And so I think that part of that was just, it was just practical with what it took to live right, you know? I mean, how are you supposed to walk around in slippers if the mud's up your knees going? Belts were a sign of pride when they first came out, but like other things, it became common practice for society and common practice for the Mennonites. As far as a plain suit, in earlier years, a longer coat was more common. The plain suit, as we know it today, was a carryover from the traditional coat worn by Western Europeans and Americans in the 17th to 19th century. During the 19th century, the Mennonites began to use the lapel coat along with a necktie. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was common that ministry wore the plain coat and laymen wore the lapel. And that was pressure. There was pressure coming from church leaders to keep the plain suit. And so the ministry were ones who started to wear it. But the lay people would not, the way I understand, they just would not quite accept that. And so that started, the presence of a double standard really bothered some ministry because they didn't like this fact that, you know, the ministry had the plain suit, but yet their lay brothers did not. And I think we can all understand their dilemma where you can't have two standards, it just don't work. But what happened there is then many of the ministry began to put away the plain coat in certain conferences. And even in the Great Awakening and some of the teachings through those early years of the 1900s, they were not able, they never did bring it back. At least that's what history says. And so I assume, now some of you men probably know better, I assume that when it was really brought back was when Eastern and Fellowship and some of those split off the conference. That's probably when the plain suit came back. I guess I'm right about that. Because the history says that years before that, they were not able to. So I assume at that point it became a test of membership. I assume that's where it came from. Well, I just have one point in closing here. As we look at this, just a little bit of history. And maybe you will throw me out for this one. I'm not sure. But I want you to hear me out, okay? I want you to hear me out. One of the things that I noticed in history I found interesting, and if I'm not careful, I could almost become cynical when I look at history and see how, you know, I'm just convinced that all we're doing is repeating history. I hope we're doing more than that. Number five, when we look at history, styles will come and styles will go. Some of where we are today is because of styles. Maybe you don't like that, but I want you to think through that, because that is, I understand that is true. Men, the pants we wear today were at one time stylish. The belts we wear today would have one time been stylish and unacceptable. The men who are here and clean shaven, and they are that way because at one time it was style, but became an accepted practice. You don't like that, but I think that's probably the sheer facts of it. And while today it seems like there's, at least in, I'm talking about in the world, there's some kind of, stylish to have some kind of facial hair. The older sisters in our conference, and I say this respectfully, tend to have shorter skirts because that was the style when they were growing up. When you grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s era, that's the way it was. The younger generation today has the longer skirts. And that came in kind of as a style. I think you agree with me on that. I'm not quite done with that yet. We'll finish that. You can also see hairstyles of people that were prominent when they were young. Can I be so blunt? I mean, I combed my hair straight back, and that's probably because I think I was a tail end of that on that style, but I guess that's why I did it. I don't really know, other than maybe it's just easier for curly hair. But, you know, the styles of some of our sisters, you can, some of that's what it is because when they were young, that was how they did it. I mean, do you understand? I'm just trying to help you understand why we have some of what we do. And it don't really seem like a style now because everybody got used to it and there's something else taking its place. And so, you know, the younger generation that likes to comb their hair straight down, when you're 20 years from now, you'll be identified as that was a style when you were young. Maybe that's offensive to you. I don't mean it to be offensive. I'm trying to make a point, okay? And I simply ask the question, are all styles bad? We are where we are in dress, some of it because of styles. Styles came, styles went. And I would like to look at the long skirt for an example. And it came in as stylish. The skirts were tighter and the bodice was tighter. It may have covered more leg, but it was many ways. It was more immodest than some of the other dresses. Now, what happened, at least what I see happened, is that because of that pressure, almost all the women started lowering their hems. And all of a sudden, you know, some of us started saying, you know what, we like the long dresses. We like what that represents. But we are going to reject the part of it that is immodest. We reject the tight bodice and the tightness around the hips and all that. And today, I would loathe to see the hems going back up again. I really would. And so I want to ask you a question. Is the point in our separated lifestyle just to be different than the world? Is that the point? Is that the point of why we dress like we do? Is it just to be different from the world? I hope not. As styles come and go, here's what I would like to help us to think about. As styles come and go, and they're going to, there's going to be, you have the young generation now, and they pass on, and another generation is going to come in, there's going to be styles that they might have that their grandmas had. As styles come and go, we reject what violates biblical principles of modesty and simplicity and accept what is within biblical principles of modesty and simplicity. And if the Bible and our church does not speak to it, then why make a big deal? I want you to think about that, because as we looked at history and as we looked at how we got to where we are, I think we need to be careful that we don't run out and just, as soon as the styles came on, that we are on the cutting edge of all of that. There is value in allowing something to not be on the cutting edge. When we're always on the cutting edge of things, we got to be careful. It speaks to something within the heart that's not good.